You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world.
You okay, we're going. So I have two power lines running to the yurt, and one of them went out, and I have to literally learn in the entire field of electronics in order to fix it, because electricians are too expensive. So we're in the dark, but of course we have headlamps, and you have a headlamp to read out of the book, and you're reading out of a book. I'm reading off my phone so I can see there, and the computer is good. So you kind of like it dark like this?
I do, I think.
So we're in a totally dark yurt in the middle of the desert, and
it's cold today.
It's cold. This fine.
I'm under like six layers of blankets.
You are.
You somehow are wearing a t-shirt.
That's right. And you have been nauseous.
I am always nauseous now.
Because you are, how many weeks pregnant are you now?
I think we're at like seven.
7 weeks pregnant. That's all, I mean, that's like almost, that's like a two-month-old fetus practically, right?
Yeah. So it's a little weird because pregnancy is assessed by the first day of your last period. So I haven't been pregnant for 7 weeks. I've only been pregnant for like, well, I think a normal person would have been pregnant for about 5 weeks. But since we did IVF, did we explain that last time? I can't even remember now.
No, maybe we should. But go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah, so mine was like 5 days less because 5 days was the baby was, or the embryo was outside the body. So it's bizarre. I don't know why they do it. I think I've heard various theories. So even though I'm 7 weeks pregnant, I've actually only had a baby in me for like, I don't know, 5 weeks.
That's just totally confusing.
Right? I know.
Yeah. Can any of this be clearer? Like, why can't this just be simpler?
Well, especially because we know the exact date of conception. It's like a little silly. So I guess it's because you don't know the exact date of conception. But the crazy thing is that you're literally you're post-designated pregnant in days that you didn't know you were pregnant in a way.
Because you're really talking about, I don't know.
It's weird. It's
first day of the, so it's
first
the,
day of your last period.
First day of your last
is
period.
Day
so
one.
It's really, instead of embryonic or fetal age, it's actually just cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
Mother cycle.
Yeah. Which then it would make so much more sense if it was the last day of your period, because then like it's like how many days have you not been bleeding for?
Yeah.
But that's a hard one to assess.
Yeah. We'll have to have a gynecologist on to explain it all to
us.
I guess we should quickly explain IVF. As I mentioned in the episode before this one, I got diagnosed with cancer in late 2018. And as I said, it was a pretty aggressive form, so they wanted to rush me into chemo. And I, about probably a day after learning that, that I was going to basically start chemo in like 2 weeks, I was sitting in bed asleep, and I shot up and I kind of did the math kind of hit me over the head, because I'd read that chemo basically kills your fast-growing cells. And I read that those were your hair cells, which is why you go bald, your gut cells, which is why there's lots of gut awfulness during chemo, your sperm cells, which are fast growing.
They said that in the article?
Yeah, and cancer cells. So it just kind of obliterates all of those cells. And I shot up in bed and thought, whoa, if it does that, maybe it's going to make me sterile. And my doctor had mentioned it, so I brought it up with my doctor, and He said, yeah, there's a 50-50 chance that you'll be sterile once you finish chemo. So I banked some sperm 7 times. It was a blast. I highly recommend it. In those 2 weeks, because we had talked about babies, and then we stuck it. We got that in the freezer. That was good. And then I did the chemo, and then it was time to do babies. And why don't you take it from there? Because then it's you.
Oh, yeah. So then we did an egg extraction at a clinic in Arizona, and we got... They got 20 eggs, but then we ended up with no viable embryos, which was pretty upsetting, obviously, perhaps. We ended up talking to a woman who's a fertility consultant, and she basically told us that you want to go to one of the top 3 labs in the world, one of which...
In the country, I think it is.
Sorry, the country, one of which is outside of New York in New Jersey, RMA of New Jersey. And we were part-time, so we went there, and I did a second round of extraction, and they got 43 eggs, and we got 15 viable embryos. So it was a much different story.
Yeah, 43 eggs, inseminated them all. Two-thirds of them die, which is apparently not very natural. Two-thirds of most pregnancies end in natural miscarriage because the embryos are not chromosomally viable. And we ended up with 15 viable, very well-graded embryos in the freezer in New Jersey, which was is a very high number, like such a high number that doctors laughed, right?
Yeah.
Like students, and when I think you said you were getting your eggs
extracted. Yeah, during the first egg transfer, they mentioned. Because they always have to ask if you will take the opposite sex if you, if like for some reason the sex you chose doesn't thaw correctly. Mm. And so it kind of comes up that would be beyond absurd with that number.
Because you have enough boys in the...
Yeah.
Or girls, whichever gender you choose.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, we have babies in the freezer, and this is so...
Right. And sorry, our nurse laughed when she told us the number. Remember that now?
Right.
In the voice note.
Right. It's a very large number. And mostly because you and I have never had fertility issues with each other.
Yeah.
So...
And an excellent lab to anyone ever considering IVF. The lab.
Yeah, let's be fair. So the public service announcement here.
Yeah.
What the consultant told us is there are 3 places you want to go in America. One is RMA, New Jersey. I don't know the names of the other two, but
one's in Denver, one's in Portland.
Yeah, one Denver and Portland.
I mean, did she say that for any, or did she say just because we had a bad luck
I don't know. That seemed to be just kind of like those are the places with
that's
the best.
That's the place
labs.
Where you know you're getting,
the best. And so when we want a baby, we just go to New Jersey and they pull one out of the freezer and they put it in you and it grows. And that's what we did, I guess, 5 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our IVF journey. And we have a boy, and we chose a girl this time, so we have a girl in there.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
It is.
Super exciting. Let us celebrate and be grateful, for it is truly snatching victory out of the jaws of defeat.
Yes.
Because we went from me being rendered sterile due to cancer to me living, not only, but also... having a whole bunch of babies sitting in the freezer staring at us ready to go. So we'll see how many we have. It's a very odd feeling.
Yes, it's very. Yes, we'll have to talk about that another time.
Yeah, that's right. So so we're here to talk about Heidegger, contributions to philosophy of the event, to continue reading through the book and discussing whatever ideas might bounce therefrom. And last week in our first episode, we read, what is called Prospect, which is kind of a tiny little foreword that he wrote. And now we're on to the different sections, and every section is numbered. There's definitely over 100. I'm not sure how many there are, but they're all fairly short. I wouldn't call them chapters. I just call them sort of sections. All right. And so we're on to section one.
Oh, my God. I think there's 268 or something like that.
Okay, 268.
Yes, but we are on one.
We're on one. Very exciting. So this is the first section, the very beginning of the book. And you're going to read, right?
Yes.
Okay, after you.
One, these, quote, contributions question along a way. These, quote, contributions question along a way which is first paved by the transition to the other beginning. The one Western thought is now entering. This way brings the transition into the open realm of history and founds the transition as a possibly very long sojourn. In carrying out the transition, the other beginning of thought always remains something only surmised, though indeed something already decided.
Yeah.
Should I keep going or no?
I just want to point out, you know, I think we mentioned last time that this book is very much about a transition from the first beginning of metaphysical, Western metaphysical thought, as typified by the Greeks, to the other, what Heidegger calls the other beginning. And as he says, this way that is the transition, this way that the transition is taking, in a sense, which is a way that Western thought is already kind of up on, is going to be a long sojourn, a long visitation, a long journey. It's not a flip of the switch, snap of the fingers. It's a long questioning, a long thinking, a long process, a long carrying out, as he said. And it's often only surmised, though definitely decided. So it's patient, and it's long form. It's a long form improv. That's it.
Accordingly, these, quote, contributions, although already and exclusively a speaking of the essence of Bang, i.e. of the, quote, appropriating event, end quote, are not yet able to join the free conjuncture of the truth of Bang outside, of the truth of Bang out of Bang itself. If this articulation once succeeds, then that essence of Bang, in its trembling, will determine the structure of the work of thought. This trembling will then strengthen into the power of the released mildness of an intimacy proper to that divinization of the God of Gods, from which occurs the assignment of Dasein to Bang as the grounding of the truth of Bang.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, I guess that could use some parsing, huh?
Yeah, I think so. I've only read it 10 times and I still can't get what it means to figure it out.
So these contributions are already and exclusively a speaking of the essence of Bang, i.e. of the appropriating event, which is a very important little section here, because we see that Heidegger believes that the phrase essence of Bang, or Bang itself, in a sense means appropriating event. So if you ever wonder what Bang means, you kind of fall back on the phrase appropriating event. So these contributions are a speaking of the essence of Bang, but they are not yet able to join the free conjuncture of the truth of Bang out of Bang itself. So they are not yet ready to take their seat, take their place in the truth of Bang out of Bang itself, probably because he considers them to be somewhat preliminary. However, if this articulation or this book succeeds, or this articulating of the essence of Bang, then that essence of Bang and its trembling will determine the structure of the work of thought. So the essence of Bang, as it is discovered in this articulation, will determine the structure of this work. So the work doesn't have a structure prior to its engagement with the appropriating event, aka bang. So I think he's like, he's lopsiding or upside downing everything as one thinks of philosophy. Because most philosophy books, most books, in fact, actually most thought, I think we could even start to talk about identitarianism here. Starts with a structure and then fills that structure out. But the structure comes first. And here he's saying the structure will actually be determined by the articulation in its trembling. And he throws that word in there right away, trembling. And that's a very Kierkegaardian phrase. It's been like a decade since I read Kierkegaard, but trembling is a Kierkegaardian word that is, I would say, indicative of kind of facing existence. We tremble in the face of existence. Mm. This trembling that in a sense is this trying to articulate bang will strengthen into the power of the released mildness of an intimacy proper to that divinization of the God of gods. So this trembling will release a mildness. So we're not trying to release an explosion. We're not trying to release a catastrophic discovery. We're not trying to release a system. We're not trying to release eureka or revelation or world-changing shit. We're trying to release mildness. And that mildness is of an intimacy proper to that divinization of the God of gods. So that mildness is essentially an intimacy that is proper to divinization. Divinization should be intimate of the God of gods from which occurs the assignment of Dasein to bang as the grounding of the truth of bang. From this divinization of the God of gods, Dasein is assigned to bang as the grounding of its truth. Hmm. And I think a couple interesting things here, like God of gods, like right away, we're in this book of philosophy written in the middle of the 20th century, and he's talking about the God of gods. He's talking about God. It's a little surprising, a little maybe even off-putting to certain people. What the heck is that word doing in here? Divinization? What is this guy, like a shaman or something? You know, it's an odd little religio song that he's playing with here. So that's curious to me. But we're going to learn what God of gods means. So, anyhow, I guess that's all I wanted to say. That's okay, nice. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'm instructing too much, but I'm just kind of unlocking what I noticed, like, our cool turns of phrase and what he's trying to drive at. But go ahead.
Yeah. Nevertheless, here already the thoughtful speaking of a philosophy within the other beginning must be attempted in the manner of a preliminary exercise. The issue is then neither to describe nor to explain, rather to promulgate.
Neither to promulgate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Neither to promulgate nor to teach. Here the speaking is not something over and against what is to be said, but is this latter itself as the essential occurrence of bang.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that one? Or?
No.
All right, well, I mean...
Apparently, I got my light fixed, so now I'm...
Oh, good. Okay, good. Your headlamp's working again?
I think so.
Did you read that whole passage in the dark?
No, it was just kind of like half lit.
Wow, incredible talent.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we see the preliminary. It's not a describing or an explaining. It's not a promulgating or a teaching. The speaking is not something over and against what is to be said, but the speaking is what is to be said itself, and the speaking is the essential occurrence of bang. So he's compounding speaking about things with the things that one is speaking about, and the things that one is speaking about are affecting the speaking, changing the speaking, being the speaking and the being, or the bang that the speaking is speaking of, is in a sense dictating the structure of the speaking. So there's a real feedback loop going on. Go ahead.
This speaking gathers bang to a first resonating of its essence and yet sounds forth itself only from this essence.
Spoken. Yeah, so the speaking resonates the essence of Bang. Yeah. And sounds out, it sounds forth out of this essence. So that's exciting. He's trying to take speaking away from a kind of rational, grammaticized diction and lexicography and repetition of a lexicography or the enclosed objective regurgitation of a lexicology and make speaking and Bang and speaking of Bang things that are kind of in a coupling or a dancing or in a reverberating together. So they're kind of like the high and the low of a sound wave. Right, so the reverberation of the sound wave has its peaks and its valleys, and the speaking and the speaking of the Bang are creating this reverberating together in kind of a natural wah 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 wah, which is a nice new, I would say, vibratory realm for philosophy. Mm-hmm. Like the philosophy's never really said, "Oh, let's," or even thought really, "Let's work in that vibratory way, and let's see vibrations as a metaphor or a template for how our thought and what we're thinking of work together." Nice. So yeah, go ahead.
That's sweet. Spoken in the preliminary exercise is a questioning that is not the purposive act of an individual nor something delimited and calculated by a community. Prior to all that, it is the passing on of an intimation that comes from and remains assigned to what is most question-worthy.
Yeah, so this preliminary exercise I'm engaging in is not an intentional, purposive act of me, nor is it something that has been prescribed and calculated by a community. It's not a communitarian action, because before all that, it is actually the passing on of an intimation. So I am passing on to you an intimation, an intimacy, a sense, an inkling, an instinct toward, and that intimation comes from and remains assigned to, remains dedicated to, and remains committed to what is most question-worthy. So I'm trying to pass on to you what I view as the most worthy of questioning. I'm not trying to pass on an answer to you. I'm trying to talk about what we probably ought to be questioning first and foremost, what is most valuable to be questioning if the goal is truth.
Yeah, okay. That's nice. Detachment from every, quote, personal domain will succeed only out of the intimacy of the earliest belonging. No grounding is granted unless such a detachment would vouch for it.
Yeah, this is really sweet. Detachment from every personal domain will succeed only out of the intimacy of the earliest belonging. So to detach from every personal domain will only succeed through an intimacy that one feels with one's earliest belonging. And without that intimacy with the earliest belonging, no grounding will be granted unless that detachment that comes out of the intimacy of the earliest belonging vouches for it. So I would say, like, yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, so I'm going to like spin a little bit out into this question of identity and in a sense, the plays I'm writing and the idea of this original belonging that forms the back matter and the essence of the transition that the plays and this book are talking about. And I think that there are phrases in here that can be transcribed into some maybe even more immediate contemporary senses, you know, and I think that detachment from every personal domain is to me really suggestive of things, you know, we talk of things about things being personal now a lot. When a thing is personal, it comes with a lot of identitarian claws in a way that the person feels engripped in. There's a lot of offense, taking offense. There's a lot of me and only me. There's a lot of lived experience. There's a lot of the primacy of the subjective, the primacy of the identified self. And to detach from every personal domain seems to me to be something really counter propositional to what people are proposing and engaging in and kind of, I would say, quite addicted to now, which is not detaching from every personal domain, but attaching to every personal domain and attaching everything else to one's personal domain and attaching only to everything else through the personal domain. But if Heidegger is suggesting to detach from every personal domain will only succeed, and so he seems to be advocating for it, out of an intimacy of the earliest belonging. So the earliest belonging, you know, that, I mean, it's kind of like, well, what is the earliest belonging? Belonging to what? What is our earliest belonging? What is the earliest belonging of a thing that can claim to be personal, that can have personality, personalness, personness? Before that personness, before that personality, before the personal, there was an earliest belonging, an intimacy of an earliest belonging. And what is that? What is that to? I think it's an important question. And it's important because Heidegger says we will never be able to ground anything. And I'm going to talk about the word grounding in a second, but we'll never be able to ground anything unless a detachment from every personal domain vouches for it, which, you know, says yes to it. Grounding is, for Heidegger, a super key term, and you know, it's not just for Heidegger, for talking and thinking and speaking and assessing truth, grounding is super important because critical, essential, basically, because unless something is grounded and you know what it's grounded on, and one can gain an admittance from others that there is a grounding and a grounding has occurred, then there is no basis for what one is saying. There is no basis for the truth that one is asserting, and nothing has a ground. So everything falls away, basically. So he's really making a really important statement about how we ought to go about getting at grounding, which is how we ought to go about getting at truth. And he's saying we need to detach from every personal domain, but only out of an intimacy of the earliest belonging. And he doesn't say what belonging to what, but I think we're going to talk a lot about that in the course of this podcast. Do you have anything that conjure any thoughts for you?
Not really. I just think it's a really sweet phrase. And he had the mildness from before. It's just like in the section, there are a lot of these really just sweet words.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost out of nowhere, but I don't know, just lend a real delicacy or like intricacy or something to it. That's very sweet.
Yeah, I like calling it sweet. I think that's right. I think one feels like there's a peace and a gentleness and in a sense a call to kindness and belonging and intimacy and meditation and grounding and vouching and passing on and asking questions. It's very uncombative and it's very almost unpersonal. It's saying that there's a place out there to go and to be and we should be peaceful with it. Mm-hmm. And we should search for that earliest belonging. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a search that I'm really excited to kind of go on.
Yeah.
But go on. I think the next paragraph is really amazing.
The age of the, quote, systems has passed. The age that would elaborate the essential form of beings from out of the truth of Bang has not yet come. In the interim, in the transition to the other beginning, philosophy needs to have accomplished something essential, the projection, i.e., the grounding and opening up of the temporal-spatial playing field of the truth of Bang. How is this unique accomplishment to be brought about? There is no precedent for it and no foothold. Mere variations on previous notions, even if these variations arise with the help of the greatest possible intermixing of historiologically familiar modes of thought, will get us nowhere. Furthermore, all worldview theories stand completely outside of philosophy, for they can exist only by denying that Bang is worthy of question. By honoring this question worthiness, philosophy possesses its own dignity, one that cannot be derived from elsewhere and cannot be calculated. All decisions regarding philosophy's dealings arise from the preservation of this dignity and as preservation of this dignity. In the realm of what is most worthy of question, however, these dealings can only constitute a unique questioning. If in any of its hidden ages, then it is in the transition to the other beginning that philosophy, in the clarity of its knowledge, must come to a decision regarding its own essence.
Yeah. You want to say anything or should I?
Go for it.
The age of the systems has passed. The age that would elaborate the essential form of beings from out of the truth of Bang has not yet come. So we're between the systems of the past and the age wherein the essential form of beings, the essential form of what is described out of the truth of Bang. So in the interim, which is where we are, aka in the transition to the other beginning, philosophy needs to have accomplished something essential. Philosophy needs to have accomplished the projection. That's the grounding. The projection means the grounding and the opening up of the temporal spatial playing field of the truth of Bang. So philosophy needs to ground and open up a new playing field for the truth of Bang, a temporal spatial playing field, a playing field of time and space in which the truth of Bang occurs. How is this unique accomplishment to be brought about? There is no precedent for it and no foothold. It has never been done, and there's nothing to stand on. It's never been done. Mere variations on previous notions, Even if these variations arise with the help of the greatest possible intermixing of historiological familiar modes of thought, will get us nowhere. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, all worldview theories stand completely outside of philosophy. All worldviews, all theories of a worldview, all theories of what the world is, all theories of how the world is, all theories of there being a world, all talk of the world is such a mess. The world has gone to hell. The world needs this. The world is this or that. These views, these theories stand completely off. Philosophy has nothing. They are literally outside of philosophy. For these worldview theories can only exist by denying that Bang is worthy of question. They only are in the denial of the worthiness, the question worthiness of Bang. Bang is not worth being questioned through these worldview theories. However, by honoring this question worthiness, by saying yes, it is question worthy, philosophy gains dignity, all decisions regarding philosophy's dealings arise from the preservation of this dignity. So philosophy needs to preserve this dignity, and in the realm of what is most question worthy, these dealings can only constitute a unique questioning. So we're going to question uniquely within this question worthy realm. And now this, if in any of its hidden ages, which probably means if in any of the hidden ages of the history of philosophy, then it is in the transition to the other beginning that philosophy and the clarity of its knowledge must come to a decision regarding its own essence. Philosophy needs to decide what its essence is. And I think Heidegger is saying that its essence is the search for the truth of Bang. Mm. And I think, you know, if you don't really care about philosophy, I relate to that. I understand that. But I think what's important for everyone else here is to understand that systems, beings of which we have not yet ascertained the essence or the form of, methods of thought that do not explore a grounded and opened up temporal spatial playing field of the truth of Bang, and worldviews and historiologically familiar modes of thought. These things are going to get us nowhere, according to Heidegger. And the worldview theories that deny the question worthiness of Bang, they're not going to get us anywhere. If philosophy needs to claim its dignity and launch away from these things, so away with worldviews, away with systems, away with historiologically established modes of thought, or historiologically familiar modes of thought, away with systems, I think I guess I'll say it. I mean, I think we've come to this time as well where thinking and certainly institutionalized thinking or university thinking, right? Has become not only routinized, but actually ideologically attached to historiologically familiar modes of thought, worldview theories, systems, and a denial that Bang is worthy of question. I think that one of the things that we want to talk about in this podcast, we mentioned the first one, you know, is a questioning of and a deconstruction of contemporary American ideological intellectualism, I guess, and the identitarianism that has afflicted it. And I think it's a good time to point out that by identitarianism, we do definitely mean what we all think of as identity, which is the various social markers that people use to give themselves a position in a certain caste system, the American caste system. But identity is also the assignment of being to things. So it's a way of establishing that certain things are, and by extension, that certain things aren't. And that this promulgation and this passion for claiming identities, which really in a sense is just this is that, or this is evil, or this is good, or this is right, or this is wrong, or this is innocent, and this is guilty, or this is acceptable, and this is unacceptable, or this is sex, and this is not sex, and this is human, and this is not human, and this is America, and this is not America. All these kind of this maelstrom of identificatory thinking and speaking, which often, more and more so, has political undertones or political objectives, is now de rigueur for every what we would call any kind of public intellectual or private intellectual or public intellectual or private intellectual not wanting to be public or whatever, you know. And this identitarianism that we're here to kind of talk about very much falls out of this paragraph in the phrases, as I said, worldview theories. You know, I can't tell you how many times I had to hang out with thinkers these days who talk about what the world is and how the world works, and just the use of the word "world" is really sloppy, and historiologically familiar modes of thought. There aren't just historiologically familiar modes of thought anymore. There are historiologically enforced modes of thought. certain modes of thought need to be enforced historiologically because
they are correct.
They are correct. And I think this is the first time we see the word historiology, and we should point out that history. So history and historiology are the two words Heidegger uses. And historiology, I would say, in this book is synonymous with story, telling stories about time, whereas history is, I would say, for Heidegger, just the way he uses the word, it's the flow of the grounding and the opening up of the temporal spatial playing field prior to historiology. Historiology is the logic of history, or the story of history, or the pattern making of history. And historiology is very popular today. And I would say, by and large, Heidegger feels that it's through and through, top to bottom, beginning to end, a complete error. That it's, or at least it's not philosophy, or which would mean it's not the search for truth. But of course, it goes under the guise of the search for truth, and in fact, it goes under the guise of the arbiter of truth. Which is why I think a lot of these things, this is why for me this book is like a hot butter knife through the grease of today. It just illuminates and encapsulates and splits up and analyzes the structure of thought and philosophy and the search for truth today. which is very systemic and very worldview theory based and very historiological. What do you want to say?
Well, first, I kind of apologize because I'm not feeling great. So I'm sorry I'm being kind of quiet.
That's but, okay.
I think, and I'm not quite sure how to say this, but I think that also the worldview theories is very in line with the anxiety stories.
Yeah, go on. I want to hear about this.
That I think that build, like, I feel like, obviously anxiety is different for everybody, but I feel like for me, my anxiety is very much based in a sort of odd narrative that I build and elaborate on and take pieces from, let's say, movies or things people have said about how the world is terrible and everybody is terrible. And just kind of like, yeah, it's the worldview I think also relates to, I guess it's an anxiety narrative that, that I feel like when I'm outside of it seems to have absolutely no relationship to, what was it? The intimacy of the earliest belonging.
Mm. Yeah.
I feel so far away.
Yeah. Yeah. So. The anxiety narrative, the narratives that foment anxiety, you know, I mean, I think we should talk about, you know, I think every person, and we've talked specifically about your life and your family, mostly because we've been talking about your anxiety. So it's not to claim that there's anything unique about you being raised by the people you were raised by, but you seem to have this real, you're in a battle with anxiety, and you seem to have made some discoveries. If I'm putting words in your mouth, let me know. I'll pull them right out, or you can spit them out at me. It seems that. Look, story has played a really important part in your life, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Story has been something that has been present in your household, growing up,
mm-hmm.
for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And and I've always known you. From the minute I met you, and in the last 15 years, story has always been something you have been fighting against.
Mm.
And you speak of it pejoratively, you demean it, you belittle it, you seem to want to fight free of it, you want to get it off you. It's like a cobweb in your face, cobweb in your mind. And then you started making discoveries that somehow anxiety was linked to story,
mm-hmm.
and stories. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's well said. I'm not sure where to go off that, though. Did you have something in mind?
Well, in what way was story present in your life?
I don't even know how to start answering that question. I guess I feel like the stories of people are always presented with a narrative arc. And as really, I guess, emotionally grabbing experiences. you know, what very well-meaning stories, but I think that something about, I think I kind of gave over power, full power to the story, and it's something I've been trying to kind of get back or release or whatever. That the story, I'd prefer story to have less power over me, whether it's stories I tell myself and get wrapped up in, or that I hear from somewhere else. So I guess I don't like the power that story has over me.
Yeah.
Should I read another paragraph or?
Sure.
The quote, other beginning, end quote, of thought is so named not because it is simply different in form from all other previous philosophies, but because it must be the only other beginning arising in relation to the one and only first beginning. From this assignment of the first and the other beginning to each other, the character of thoughtful meditation in the transition is already determined. Transitional thinking accomplishes the grounding projection of the truth obeying as historical meditation. History is thereby not the object and sphere of a spectating, but is that which first awakens and brings about thoughtful questioning as the site of the decisions of history. In the transition, thought places in dialogue the first having been of the bang of truth and the extreme to come of the truth of bang. And in that dialogue brings to words the hitherto uninterrogated essence of bang. In the knowledge belonging to the transitional thinking, the first beginning remains decisive as the first and yet is indeed overcome as a beginning. For this thinking, the clearest respect paid to the first beginning, a respect that first discloses this beginning in its uniqueness, must be accompanied by the disrespect of the renunciation implicit in another questioning and speaking.
Yeah. So the other beginning of thought which we're seeking is named that not because it's simply different in form from all previous philosophies, but because it must be the only other beginning arising in relation to the one and only first beginning. It's the only other beginning that is possible out of the one and only first beginning, the beginning of Western metaphysical thought. From this assignment of the first and the other beginning to each other, so the first beginning and the other beginning are they are made a couple. A team. The character of thoughtful meditation in the transition is also already determined. So how thoughtful meditation in the transition is going to happen is already determined because these two beginnings have been assigned to each other. This transitional thinking from the first to the other beginning accomplishes the grounding projection of the truth of bang as historical meditation. So it's historical meditation. That we're looking for. History is thereby not the object and sphere of a spectating. It's not a thing that you look at, but is that which first history is what first awakens and brings about thoughtful questioning as the site of the decisions of history. Thoughtful questioning, history gives birth to thoughtful questioning as the site of the decisions of history, of where history's decisions are made. And in the transition, thought places in dialogue the first having been of the bang of truth and the extreme to come of the truth of bang. Right? And in that dialogue, in the dialogue between the having been of the bang of truth and the to come of the truth of bang, in that dialogue, it brings to words the hitherto uninterrogated essence of bang, the never before discussed and never before questioned essence of bang. In the knowledge belonging to transitional thinking, The first beginning remains decisive. So we're not getting rid of it as the first beginning, and yet is indeed overcome as a beginning. So we are going to overcome this first beginning. For this thinking, the clearest respect paid to the first beginning must also be accompanied by a disrespect that renounces it in preference for another questioning and speaking, a different questioning and thinking. So he's talking about the transition that we're engaged in here. Well, I think we might as well, we're almost to the end of the section. I think we might as well just dive in because this section lays out the six main characters of this transition. So go ahead.
The outline of these, quote, contributions toward the preparation of the transition is taken from the still unmastered ground plan of the historicality of the transition itself, the resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones, the last God. This outline is not a series of various considerations on sundry objects, nor is it a step-by-step ascent from the low to the high. It is a preliminary sketch of the temporal spatial playing field, which the history of the transition first creates as its own realm in order to decide. According to its own law about the futureless ones, i.e. those who are always only, quote, eternal, and about the future ones, i.e. those who occur only once.
So he offers an outline of this book right here. The outline of these contributions toward the preparation of the transition is taken from the still unmastered ground plan of the historicality of the transition itself. So the historicality of the transition itself, the ground plan of that historicality, which is still unmastered, is the source of these contributions as we prepare for this transition. And that outline is the six things you said: the resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones, and the last God. So what we have to remember is what he's really talking about is we're in this interim between the first and the other beginning, in which we're trying to ground and open up a spatial-temporal playing field for the discovery of the essence of Bang or the truth of Bang. Mm-hmm. And in this trembling, in this reverberative phase between the systems of the past and the Bang, the appropriation of the future, where we are headed, where we're transitioning to, these six aspects are... They're not just, as he says, a series of various considerations. They're actually an outline of the transition itself. And they are the resonating, the interplay, the leap, the grounding, the future ones, the last God. And so the resonating harkens back to that vibratory thing that I was talking about between thought and Bang. So the resonating, the sounding of this transition as speaking and thinking are appropriated by Bang and cause a sound. The interplay, which is the interplay of these elements as they play together and begin to create new castles and forts and, the things we play with and the things we create when we play. The leap, which is the leap toward toward the appropriating event, toward Bang, toward through the transition. So it requires a leap, aka leaping choya. The grounding, so then grounding this truth of Bang. So the grounding is going to be a process, a part of this process. The future ones, and those are the ones doing this stuff. And the last God. And the last God, we're going to hear a lot about that. But in a sense, there have been gods throughout history, lots of gods. And all gods have been based on a metaphysical addiction of the people that herald that God is the one and only God. And we keep cycling through gods. And Heidegger is suggesting that this transition will lead us to a state of being in which the last God occurs and there aren't any more gods, because it's impossible via the process that emerged and the people who then declare that God that there would be any other God after that, because of the way that God came about. Now, whether that's possible or not, we'll see, but that's his supposition. And then he finishes with this book is a preliminary sketch of the temporal spatial playing field, which the history of the transition first creates as its own realm. In order to decide, according to its own law, about the futureless ones, i.e. those who are always only, quote-unquote, eternal, and about the future ones, i.e. those who occur only once. So this distinction between futureless ones and future ones is made odd by saying that the futureless ones are those who are always only eternal, and the future ones occur only once. And this is where I would throw in identity, in that the futureless ones, who really, in a sense, because of their encasement in identity, are not engaging with the temporal spatial playing field, and therefore, in a sense, have no future, and are in, therefore, in a sense, basically eternal, aka stagnant, aka removed from the temporal spatial playing field, aka dead, aka they have an identity. And then there's the future ones who he, you know, are in a sense, he's saying are the people who are engaging and fomenting this transition. And they only occur once. They occur just once. They are not eternal. They are like a flash in the pan, or in Heideggerian speak, a flash in the temporal spatial playing field. They do not have an identity. Because identity is uniformity over time, uniformity over space, sameness. Identity is sameness. Identity is entombment in a category. Identity is, in a sense, anonymity through being absorbed into a community. Identity is the perpetuation of a label, whereby one determines one's value and one's worth in a marketplace. And identity is projection. And by projection, I mean identity is taking the thoughts of others as one's own thoughts and feeling that they're one's own thoughts, feeling that they are personal for one, but they're in fact just other people's thoughts. And that's how identity perpetuates itself. And it makes you eternal, and it makes you futureless, and it makes you comfortable, and it makes you the hero of a story. It makes you innocent. It makes you right. It makes you good before your God. It makes you eternal. But of course, it actually doesn't.
Well, I think, I just want to say real quick, I think that your use of projection is different than his.
It is.
So they're actually kind of opposite. I just want to clarify that.
Well, what's his?
Well, I think, so because he said before projection, he said, okay, in the interim, in the transition to the other beginning, philosophy needs to have accomplished something essential, the projection, i.e. the grounding and opening up of the temporal spatial playing field of the truth of being.
Absolutely.
And so that's literally, I think, the opposite.
Is this not a perfect time to look at the German?
Yeah, that's
right. This word projection.
Yeah.
Because I know this is also a word that
I mean,
Freud uses.
Yeah, right.
Projection is a big word for Freud. But I think it would be interesting to hear what, because I think you're, it's really right of you to point out this word projection as he uses it, because I've never quite understood how he uses that word, and what that word is for him. So where do we see that word the first time?
So it was on, so it was back a page. Under, it's in the paragraph, "The age of the quote systems has passed."
Ah, yes. Yeah, good. Die Zeit der Systeme ist vorbei. Yeah, good. The age of the system is past. Yes. Oh, it's right before. Yeah, exactly. Inzwischen muss die Philosophie im Übergang zum anderen Anfang ein wesentliches geleistet haben. Den Entwurf. Good. So he uses the word Entwurf. So let's see what that means. I'm literally reading a French-German dictionary in the dark. So it's like double dark. Entwerfen. Program, plan, Entwurf, project. Design. Yeah. Esquisse. I wonder what that means. And yeah, so projection, it seems to me that what he's saying, projection for Heidegger kind of means, yeah, it's interesting, an estimate or forecast of a future situation or trend based on a study of present ones. A projection is what we think is going to happen in the future,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But Entwurf also means purpose, plan, intention, design. Entwurf, yeah. In English, draft, outline, sketch. Yeah, mm-hmm. So he's using it as, in a sense, a plan,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. I like sketch. Kinda.
Now, here's how Freud uses the word projection. Thoughts, motivations, desires, and feelings that cannot be accepted as one's own are dealt with by being placed in the outside world and attributed to someone else. And we use that now. You're projecting,
mm-hmm.
right? You're projecting onto me, which in a way is, you know, it's like film, right? You're projecting a movie onto me. Mm-hmm. Like you're using me as a film screen for your own movie. Because
which
you can't,
is very like related to transference with Freud,
yes,
as well.
That's right.
That's a similar.
That's right. And so when I'm using the word projection, I'm using the idea of what I would call third person thoughts,
mm-hmm.
what other people say or what we ascribe to other people as saying.
Third person thoughts. That's a really good phrase.
Yeah. Are projected back onto the perceiver of those third-person thoughts and come and made to be first-person thoughts or experienced as first-person
mm-hmm,
thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's integral to the perpetuation of identity.
Wait, can you say that one more time? Third-person thoughts projected back onto...
Third-person thoughts projected back onto the person that makes those things third-person thoughts, and it
right.
is because they are the first in the first person, and those third-person thoughts are then felt and experienced as first-person thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's that there are lines and bylaws and expressions and proprieties and rules and definitions and stories and propositions that are accepted and part of the system that we are fighting to defend. And they are third person thoughts. They're the thoughts of a he or a she or a they. We recognize them as the thoughts of other people, and then we take those thoughts and they become our first person thoughts as if we're thinking them.
Yeah.
As if they're, and you know, we think of thought as being the kind of last flare-up of a series of instinctual emergences. Thoughts are supposed to be unique to the person having them. They pop out of one's head, in a sense. But when they are the third-person thoughts of other people, and they come to have the guise of being first-person thoughts, they are not instinctual effulgences. They are just projections of others' thoughts into one's self, and yet they're taken as first-person thoughts. So they bear the weight of the personal. They bear the weight of the agential and the authentic and the from within, from the deeply honest and sincere internal sense of thinking. But in fact, they're just projections. So in a sense, it's the opposite of Freudian projection. Freudian projection is, right, the first person projects onto the third person. This type of projection, identitarian projection I'm talking about, is projection of the third person onto oneself. And it's very much a wanting to belong. It's very much a wanting to think like other people and fall in line with the thought of other people and have what are feel like very unique thoughts, but are really just repeated thoughts. But uniqueness and repetition, when one wants to meld into a community, are the same thing. But it definitely makes everything very muddy, right? And so it comes back to what you're talking about, kind of like other people's stories claiming you.
Yeah.
And that feeling really rapey.
Yeah.
Maybe. Sorry, am I allowed to use that word?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And you have a long history with story, and I suppose we're probably not going to talk about it tonight.
Yeah.
I think we need to talk about it.
Yes.
I think we need to talk about it. I think we'll talk about it next time.
I don't even know what you're referencing. But let's not. Let's not. I agree. Well, and I think Heidegger is using projection in a fairly different way.
I agree.
So I think that's sort of like, I think it's more of the plan or the sketch or
yes.
the project.
That's
or,
right. The I design. Mean,
the design, yeah. Yeah.
I think he really is, yeah. I think the German word for projection as Freud uses it, which is probably grounded in like early film.
Yeah, like literally, sounds like
projecting
film.
Onto something.
Yeah.
Is probably a completely different word. Freud's probably not even using the word Entwurf.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Yeah. It's been translated in English to projection and Heidegger's, but it's probably totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really well said. That's interesting.
So I think next time I definitely want to dive into the linkages between story, identity, and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that you and I have obviously had years of, I think, very fruitful discussions about the intersection of those three things.
Mm-hmm.
And how story causes identity, identity causes anxiety, anxiety causes a need for story, which causes a need for identity, and blah, blah, blah. And it goes in this big loop, right? And it's a story of subjection and a story of hope and a story of terror.
Beautiful.
Right?
Well said,
and So I think next time, I think we should dive into that. We'll read more Heidegger, obviously, but the connections between anxiety, story, and identity would be a super exciting place to go next time.
Totally.
Did you have a thought?
Oh, I was just going to say, somewhere in here, I was like, I feel like that's also sort of like what we call gaslighting. Like, I feel like there's some element in which, like, these projections, these third person thought projections, have this like really strong power, and in a way feel like, I guess I'll speak about myself, just like they're gaslighting me into like believing them, when I mean I'm also being vulnerable to it, but there's just something very very insidious about it. It feels like an earworm or something. You just can't get out.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, let's read the definition of gaslighting here. It's an insidious form of manipulation and psychological control. Victims of gaslighting are deliberately and systematically fed false information that leads them to question what they know to be true, mm-hmm. often about themselves. They may end up doubting their memory, their perception, and even their sanity. Now, I think mm-hmm. that gaslighting is usually spoken of as, it says here, as an insidious form of manipulation and control, as if gaslighting is an intentional crime, mm-hmm. an intentional act of deception and destabilization of a person's sense of themselves. But, you know, I think what you're saying is that gaslighting is not even necessarily just, is not something that some villain does, but that projection, the way mm-hmm. I'm using projection and gaslighting are very similar
yeah.
in that others' thoughts carry a almost, when I would say there's sort of a way that there's something where like biological agents carry other biological agents on them, like mm-hmm. they piggyback yes. on each other. And there's a way in which what we're saying here is that people's thoughts can come into one's head as thoughts, but then when piggybacking on those thoughts, or kind of parasitically embedded in those thoughts as a kind of a as a kind of a host parasite situation, mm-hmm. comes intentions, objectives, urges to control, urges to in story, urges to narrativize, urges to appropriate and mm-hmm. and own.
Yeah, that's right.
That aren't necessarily intentional.
Yeah,
but they're part of the structure of the communicative act
mm-hmm.
that the person who's communicating has come to accept as natural to communication mm-hmm. and maybe even important and maybe mm-hmm. even essential and mandated mm-hmm. within the societal rigors that everyone's acting under, right? And then you're having thoughts. So then you're sitting there and you're having thoughts and you're saying, where did these thoughts come from?
Yeah.
Why am I having them? Which ones are authentic? Which ones were handed to me? Which ones were tattooed onto me? Which ones were forced onto me? How did they get into me? Who am I? Where is yeah. this all? Where did this all come from? Why was this done to me?
Yeah.
How did I get here? Who am I? Right?
Totally.
And then when your thoughts are not your own, but yet they feel like your own, but yet you know they're not your own, but they feel like your own,
mm-hmm.
you're really caught in a conundrum of being and non-being, of mm-hmm. self and non-self, of mm-hmm. identity and non-identity. And you get anxious.
Yeah. Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
You don't know whether you're coming or going. You don't know who is coming or going. You don't know if you're good or bad for yourself.
Yeah.
Right? You don't know if you're safe or dangerous to yourself. And you don't know how to trust yourself. You don't know how to judge whether you can be trusted. Because for years and years and years, you were given thoughts that you were told way before you could even ascertain whether this was fair to say to someone or not, thoughts that you were told must be yours, should be yours.
Mm-hmm.
And totally. In a sense, you're beholden to take them as your own, because if you don't, you're hurting people. You're abandoning people.
Mm-hmm.
You're guilty of not honoring people, and you're guilty of not joining and being in the same mindset as other people.
Mm-hmm.
The degree to which people want and the degree to which they work to get other people to think just like them is monstrous.
Yes.
And story is one of the great submarines of that Navy. You see?
Yeah.
Story is how that nation mobilizes itself overseas to force its form of governance onto other people and its ways of thinking on other people. Story is how identity imperializes the world.
Yeah, and I think there's something, just going back a little, I wanted to touch on where you said that story comes with a desire to appropriate the listener. And I think there is like a real aggressive feeling of appropriation there. And it's interesting because I feel like Heidegger talks about a very different kind of appropriating of the event and creating a distance and a, I will be really curious to hear how his appropriation happens. So I feel like I am most used to the other kind of appropriation.
Yeah, well, I think that the kind of appropriation you're talking about is people appropriating other people.
Yes.
People using thought to appropriate the thoughts of others.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost just reminded in this, and Heidegger is talking about events.
Yes.
Appropriating us, appropriating our thinking. Mm-hmm. So he's not talking about an interpersonal event.
Right.
He's talking about, in a sense, we need to be appropriated.
By let our ourselves. Own events.
That's right. We need to be let it's, ourselves be appropriated by events and by bang,
right?
And by the earth and by time and by space and by what's happening, by reality. I don't know. You know.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that I would say, and what he's saying is people with worldview theories view that whole project as bullshit.
Yeah.
And not worthy of question. How to do that is not worthy of asking. And that's because those people, those worldview theory people, are engaged in a different form of appropriation. They're still engaged in appropriation. They're still appropriative beings.
Mm-hmm.
But their appropriation is communitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Their appropriation is ideological. Their appropriation is interpersonal because they haven't detached from all personal realms. They're actually nothing but personal realms. And they're nothing but about procreating and propagating and enforcing the attachment to their personal realms. And so they are the futureless ones. They are the eternal ones. They are the identitarians who cannot be appropriated to the temporal spatial playing field of Bang because they are appropriating the interpersonal, futureless, eternal realm of identity.
And you can't be appropriated if you're always appropriating.
That's right. Exactly. Which is why Heidegger speaks of mildness.
Yeah.
Why he speaks of renunciation.
Yeah.
Why he speaks of detachment. What he's saying is we need to detach from this obsession with appropriating others so we can be appropriated.
Yeah.
Not by others, but by the earth.
Yeah.
and I'm not sure if that's the right word for it, but by bang. Yeah. That's the word he uses. And what bang is, is, you know, another thing. But and that's the transition. Mm-hmm. The transition, the first beginning is appropriating others into one's story to propagate one's identity. The other beginning is dropping that action, that obsession, that addiction, that ideology, that political activism, and heading out to be appropriated by the event.
Great.
Right? That's the transition. That's where we want to go.
Yeah.
That's what we want to leave behind, and that's where we want to go. And I would say that that transition will involve anxiety.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Right.
So it's not just that we're leaving anxiety and that we're leaving the world of anxiety. Right. Heading out of the world of anxiety will involve anxiety.
Right. Totally.
But
because it's such a question. Well, it's like, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, so it's a questioning, or to leave the first beginning is a big deal.
And I feel
like the first beginning is always like, but wait.
Exactly, because the first beginning, because the first beginning is a thousands and thousands of year old system of appropriation.
Yeah.
Seeking to appropriate you into an identity.
Mm-hmm,
that's its whole thing. And we've become used to it. We've become used to living in it. We've become used to its constant knocking at our head.
Yeah.
Like that's what thought is. That's what life is now.
Yeah.
We are being appropriated by others. Others are trying to appropriate us into their identities.
Yeah, totally.
And get us to have their identity.
Totally.
And to leave that, transition out of that, is a big move.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to involve some anxiety if one has become so used to this thing that stepping out of it starts to feel a little confusing and scary and disoriented.
Yeah, and I think, I don't think we'll get into it today, but I feel like it's what we're seeing in the news right now. And I feel like it's also something that goes back to our question of, is there a way to raise our kid without this somehow?
Exactly. So I think that's next time.
Yeah.
How to raise our kid outside of this appropriating obsession and get them into being appropriated by the event.
Mm-hmm.
And we could even touch on some stuff in the news if we want. Yeah. Of course, what's in the news then will be different than
it's
now.
It's true. It'll be totally
It'll still different. Be there. It'll all still be there. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.
From the dark yurt, we bid you good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.